Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Our special guest for this edition, who I want to welcome to the session, is Maria Flores Portillo, General Manager for Amobi in EMEA. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you for having me. Really happy to be here.
Not at all. And, of course, over from the Walthamstow Studios, Lindsay Rountree. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm good, but I don't know if I'll last a full hour because it's really hot in this room and I've had to turn all the fans off, close the windows, and because there's building work going on the other side of my garden. So I might start flagging just to warn you. If you see me dripping, then send help, please.
Yes, we will. And also that will be really good timekeeping for us. So as we see you wilting bit by bit, we'll sort of speed up. And actually, that's a good point, listeners. It's really warm and sunny here in London. What a treat, right? And I didn't check with you, Maria. Where are you? Are you in central London somewhere?
Yeah, I wouldn't say central. I'm kind of like in the suburbs, yes. But also boiling. Thanks, Lindsay, for bringing it up. Let's do this quick.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Hot and steamy podcast. Okay. So discussion of the first news story I wanted to raise with you guys. The WFA have released quite an interesting report on a study that they did into the future role for the CMO. They've called it the CMO conundrum. They undertook the report by surveying a number of marketing professionals across 28 other global advertising associations. They conducted some sort of 700 face-to-face interviews in addition to the survey data that they got. So it's quite a broad-reaching study into the perspective of marketing professionals on their role and what the future of their role looks like. Some things that I thought were interesting in this, particularly because we've been discussing, of course, the sort of the role of the marketer and how brands and advertisers are behaving in this sort of pandemic environment, was that they got marketers' views on how they think their roles have changed and what they think are going to be the most important skills in those roles going forward. And so some of the key findings were that marketers were reporting that they're becoming much more part of that C-suite's senior executive team within their organisations. Again, I know that's a sort of a trend that we've been talking about over the last couple of years, but this was people actually saying that shift has happened within their organisations. They talked a little bit about obviously what the current crisis is doing to the way that they focus their spend and their attention, but that actually that was bringing just more into a sharp focus than ever before how important that CMO role is, which is probably another reason for it being in the C-suite within a lot of organisations. And the other thing they talked about are the types of skills, as I mentioned earlier, that they feel they're going to be needing over the coming years. And there was a lot of people reporting that they felt that they were going to be spending a big proportion of their time on assessing the suitability of technology platforms that they're using and also becoming, I suppose, custodians of customer data in ways that they haven't perhaps necessarily done before. Not to mean that they haven't used customer data before, but that they are seeing their role around sort of preserving and protecting that customer data as much more pivotal than ever before. So I thought those were some really interesting findings, and I'm very keen to hear what you both think about it. Maria, what was your point of view on some of the findings in this report?
Yeah, I obviously agreed with all of them. I did have a bit of a reaction of how is this news when I read the report, to be honest, from the perspective that, yes, no, in a very respectful way. But the report made a lot of emphasis around CMOs having to become good team leaders. And in my experience with CMOs, CMOs have been needing to be good team leaders for a long time. I actually find that...
Don't worry, street traffic. Yeah. It's all yeah. And you warned us beforehand that we might have some children in the background shortly too. So it's okay.
They'll make an appearance at some point. in my experience, I think CMOs are actually a role that is quite challenging. They have to context switch a lot because they need to be able to drive a brand forward. They need to be able to deliver acquisition and maintain their customers and drive loyalty. And now they also in charge of things like sustainability and so on. So you can only do that if you're a good team leader, simply because you have a lot of different talent across all of those functions. And especially now with the more technical and data-driven functions come in under the wing as well. And the best CMOs that I've met have not been the creative types, have been the ones that were excellent leaders and could actually use all of those resources properly for the organization. So that bit was not news. But in general, I would say, you know, the emphasis on the data piece and how they are becoming a lot more savvy from a technology perspective, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, you're right, you know, it does feel like we've been discussing some of these findings with respect to the CMO role for quite some time. So how is this different? I guess maybe my thinking was perhaps it just means that some of those changes that we thought might happen to CMO roles are actually happening now. And I'm referring particularly to that focus on the data and technology aspect of their roles. What was your perspective, Lindsay?
I think that's an interesting point. And I think that if you look at the different capacities in which a CMO needs to now operate, it's almost like marketing actually needs a rebrand, because it's not, how are we defining marketing? And if you think back to a few years ago, there was a joke around the marketing team were always referred to as the colouring in club. And they're long beyond that now in terms of how they have to navigate data and even areas like sustainability. Then a few years ago, there was a talk about that the new CMO is the CMTO or the CTMO, bringing technology into that marketing role. And we're seeing that evolve more and more. And I think this just highlights that evolution is still ongoing, but looks so different business to business. Like, these are senior marketers at big companies, apparently globally. And they talk about sustainability being a big part of what they're having to do in the CMO role. But actually, a lot of these big brands already have chief sustainability officers as a separate role. And they either sit within the marketing side or the operations side, or they sit alongside the commercial side. So I think there's a lot more merging together of all of the C-suite, actually. If you look at what a board looks like now, the C-suite kind of, they're all having to do each other's jobs. And I remember a few years ago, we were trying to hire digital execs at my last role, and we were talking about the fact that we need people that have got tech backgrounds, that have got all these different kind of STEM type degrees, and that know how to manipulate data. I remember somebody else in the room going, please, can we just look for someone that has the ability to have humanities, somebody who can actually read and write English? And that was just forgotten about over and above data, and that's what we need now in marketing, the data side of things. But actually, we need somebody that can do every single bit of those things. And we're seeing more and more CMOs having come from a data background, a tech background, that they have done from a more traditional marketing background. And that definitely is looking at how that's helping us redefine the CMO role. But I think we need somebody who is not even jack of all trades, but master of all trades. And that's why marketing in some cases can still be kind of frowned upon, but in many cases, it's looked on as the kind of the beacon of the company that's tying all these different things together. But there are many companies where that marketing role isn't tying them together, and where they need to. And that's probably where the evolution of marketing will happen more. Like, Maria, you're talking about the good CMO is the team leader, and that's what you're looking for. And that's what a good CMO needs to be. And that this team leader is that person that will bring all these different functions together under one umbrella. And maybe marketing itself shouldn't be sitting in the C-suite. Maybe it should be called something else. And marketing is one function of that, because it's becoming more and more complex. As we understand, marketing used to just be putting your product out there to somebody. But now with so much more looking at the outcomes of business and looking at things like sustainability and what is it a consumer wants. A consumer doesn't just want a product. They want a lifestyle. They want to be able to know the background, the source of everything that they're buying or everything they're looking at. So the role of the marketing extends beyond that to the entire consumer decision journey or purchase funnel, however you look at it, not just the very top of that where they're going, here's a product, go and buy it. And I think that's where the term marketing is kind of going through a change. But Maria saying this isn't news, I agree with you, because this is just highlighting the fact that there is an evolution that is still ongoing. It's been ongoing for 20 years, and it's still ongoing, basically.
And maybe they're finally getting out of the, like you say, finally getting away from the tag, the colouring in club, and being seen as something else. Maria, sorry, I didn't mean to cut across you there. Were you going to say something else?
I was going to say that, you know, not to dominate too much the conversation with COVID, but this situation has actually cast CMOs kind of like front and center of the response of their entire organization to the pandemic. And I think it's been an opportunity for many of them to actually show character and to do the right things, to influence at the right levels and play perhaps a little bit more offense than defense. So even in situations like this, with this sort of drastic change across the board, will help with this acceleration of the role of the CMO in taking a more important function or role within the leadership suite.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, because the CMO isn't just looking after marketing budgets. So you would think that some of these big companies, they're just slashing marketing budget, in some cases stopping marketing altogether and going through a quiet period. That means the CMO role is now defunct, surely. But actually the CMO role within that becomes more important than ever, because they have to look at how they can bring their company out of the rebound, but also look at their existing customers, look at how they can drive customer loyalty, and try and look at other strategies that aren't promoting a product to a brand new audience, but trying to maintain their existing audience.
Might we start to see some people getting into marketing that don't necessarily come from traditional marketing trained backgrounds? You know, might we start to see people that are actually have got, say, for example, some slightly more technical, skills in their background getting into the marketing field? And then might that be some of the sort of catalyst for the change in the way that organizations see marketing? A bit like you were describing earlier, Lindsay, this idea that, you know, often organizations want to recruit people from a bit of a multidisciplinary background, because they accept that, you know, you're generally employing a person not just to do one job, but to do, you know, sort of a facet of things and to have a bit of expertise in one field. So, yeah, what do you think about that? Do you think we might see some marketing professionals coming from different backgrounds?
I think we already do. Sorry, I don't know if the question was for Lindsay.
No, either of you, please jump in.
No, I think we already do. I think, you know, many marketing departments are reinforcing themselves with data science and analytics and all of that, right? And that reflects the current situation. Especially, again, going back to the same topic, but in climates like these where there's so much change around your audience in terms of the behavior, the intent, the disposable income or whatnot, you need to be on top of these things. And CMOs will need all of these tools to be able to take the right decisions. I have a slightly different view from Lindsay to say about the CMOs being master of all trades, because I think it's really difficult to master everything. I think as a leader, you need to have an understanding of the important levers and some of the sort of like unit economics across all of those functions that are behind a marketing role. But it is important to speak that language, but however, to mostly to make sure that you have the right people in place. And for that, you will need a level of diversity in these times that would be much bigger than before, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think you're absolutely right, Maria. When I say master of all trades, I don't necessarily think they should be, but I feel like for many companies, it's what's becoming expected of them. And that could be dangerous, because then you're losing the ability to, you can't find somebody who is an absolute expert in all of the different functions. And then the expectations of what a CMO looks like will become so unbelievable, unattainable, that we're going to start putting a lot of CMOs under massive pressure at the moment by making them be involved in every single little thing. And that's not fair on them when their job is big enough as it is. And I think that exactly to your point, Maria, kind of the skills that they need to have, that's why it needs to be redefined. Like, what should an ideal CMO have? And this report goes into the soft skills that those marketers expect to have, as well as the hard skills they expect to have. And I think that they themselves, that they're basically saying we can't be everything. And I think that needs to be remembered by these big companies. Like, your CMO cannot be everything. Nobody in your C-suite can be everything.
No, and I think that's a really important point as well, connecting a little bit to what Maria just said about leadership too, is that, you know, you need to have some specifically identifiable skills and some areas of expertise. But the other good sort of leadership quality is also being able to employ lots of people who are experts in other fields that you're not an expert in, and knowing how to get the best out of them, and to, you know, and to ensure that those skills are being expertly deployed across the organization or across a project. I feel like this could be a whole sideline podcast on leadership. Anyway, I'm going to move us on to the next story, which is somewhat connected in that it's relating to marketing spend. News this week in Marketing Week that Marks and Spencer have actually cut their marketing spend by $50 million. Most of this reduction in spend is coming from TV and press, but they've also come out to say that they are shifting budget into social and digital channels. Not that surprising in the current set of circumstances, particularly given that, you know, obviously their stores are not open except for their food outlets. And so there's going to be, you know, a significant feeling within the organisation that there's no point in spending money on a part of the organisation that's not, you know, openly accessible to people at the moment. But what I found interesting about this article was the conversation about how they're actually expecting to shift their marketing spend going forward, and that it's this particular set of circumstances has really made them focus on their online offering and their digital sales offering and how that should be organized and what technology tools they need in place to make sure that that's working well. So I'm interested to hear what you've got to say about this and what you thought was interesting about it. I also wondered whether it's an example of the impact that this crisis is having on some marketers' TV spends and whether it will be an opportunity for digital channels to shine in this type of environment. You know, maybe those two aren't sort of necessarily directly connected, because maybe big brands like Marks and Spencer aren't going to pull their TV spend and just push it all into digital. But surely this is a bit of an opportunity in that environment. And I also thought the other thing that was interesting that I want some commentary from both of you on is that, you know, they seem to be very focused on the idea of, okay, we're removing this pot of marketing budget because there's no point in spending it there, and we're going directly into performance. And, you know, what does that say about the possibilities of, you know, sort of programmatic channels driving brand awareness as well as performance? It seems like they, at the moment, they see the two as distinctly different. So lots of things to potentially discuss there. Let's start with you, Lindsay. You're already making faces at me like she's asking too many questions.
Yes, I found the article really interesting. I felt that there was one thing that particularly stuck out to me that was, I think it's a CMO of Marks and Spencer's, which just really highlights them as still thought of in this country as a legacy brand, a traditional retailer, where he referred to, you know, that the nice old-fashioned media is no longer a requirement for us. Basically, we're going digital. Then he's just referring to TV and out of home as this nice old-fashioned media, and referring to TV and out of home as purely above the line and anything digital as below the line, and referring to its performance-based versus brand-based. And there'll be a lot of people that read that will roll their eyes, a lot of marketers that roll their eyes going, that's not what marketing is. And the fact that you've come out and said that, and I think that, I guess the way the article is written, it makes it look like they've cut £50 million of their spend and it's going digital, like 50 million was going to TV. There's obviously two different things here. One is they cut their budget because they're not getting the traffic they used to, they're not getting the customer they used to, they had to close all their stores, because obviously they're a massive physical retailer in the UK. But the other side of it is the budget they do have left, they are putting into what they're referring to as below the line spend, which is digital activity. But then they're putting it into social, which arguably social is not particularly performance-based. So social is such a hybrid of performance and brand that it just doesn't make sense to me. So there were lots of things I wanted to unpick from that kind of didn't make a lot of sense to me in terms of how brands like Marks and Spencer's, that are such traditional legacy brands in this market, are looking at their marketing spend. And it highlights there are a lot of brands out there that still refer to those different channels like that. And I think that's a concern. And there's a lot of companies now that are using this time during COVID to be able to go, okay, how do we reset? What does digital transformation look like for us? Let's speed this up. Now's the time for us to go away and do our housekeeping, look at what we want to be like when we come out of this. And I think that they could and should be the same way, but they're kind of going at it backwards. And they refer to themselves as a pure play. They refer to the fact they're getting a trickle of sales through from fashion, and it's all kind of online stuff. And you sort of think, well, you could actually do some branding, some marketing if you wanted to. We've talked really time on this podcast about the brands that will survive this are the ones that are visible, no matter what, in what guise they're visible. And M&S have always been very, very good at branding. Like they've got very memorable TV ads, very memorable ads in general. So they could have used that to their advantage if they wanted to, and they've chosen not to because they're not getting any sales through the door, obviously. I don't know. I just found the whole thing very, very strange, really.
Contradictory. A few contradictory messages in there, I thought.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, you know, arguably, you know, push a bit of brand spend into digital channels, and then you might actually get some really high volume digital sales. Maria,
I agree. I had the exact same reaction, Lindsay. I felt the response was so weirdly binary. In the sense that, you know, because people are not outside, we just need to spend all of our money on digital. It's like, oh my God, you know, like there's so many wrong things about that statement. But it is what it is. I agree with what you said. I think branding can come from many different channels. TV today is cheaper than ever. You know, I'm just going to say it because you don't necessarily need to even go to digital. And I think, you know, whilst it's good practice, obviously, to look at your marketing spend and cut down if you have to, given the climate. I do think there needs to still be an emphasis on branding to make sure that you come out of this crisis in a very good way and in a position of strength. Equating digital to performance is just really bizarre in this age. And it feels that kind of like, you know, they're seeing it that way. Outside of that, you know, the fact that digital is a great medium for having more data and more precise measurement, you know, in some ways, and also have a bit of less risk in terms of commitment, right? You can kind of like test and see what's working, what's not working, and so on. As a marketer, I can see how digital is very appealing. And I do think that some behaviors will change to one of your three questions in one, Rachel.
Sorry.
It is true. I do think that this situation will create some level of, you know, eye-opening for some more, I would say, traditional brands that maybe have used less digital and so on in terms of the power of digital for even for things like branding, definitely. And that will create a level of inertia. So some media that are connected to digital platforms like digital out of home or connected TV should benefit from this. But I think the view is a little bit too binary in, you know, with regards to this particular brand. Yes.
Yeah, it's just so interesting because you would have thought if anyone is in a position to capitalize on their brand and drive more customers to digital platforms at the moment, it's got to be someone like Marks & Spencer. You know, it's just such a well-known brand. They must have the ability, you know, even if they were to see it as a bit of a risk, it can't have any more potential downsides than anything else that they're trying at the moment. It just feels like such an opportunity, I suppose. I mean, this might not be connected at all, but, you know, they're soon going to be selling their food via Ocado, right, as a sort of a, you know, almost like a kind of a third-party online seller, if you like. I wondered if maybe any of that's connected. Perhaps they've got this view of the digital customer as something that they're just not that, you know, that's just not that aligned with their brand and their core customers, because they just don't seem to have been very front-footed in that digital offering. Yet I can't see how people wouldn't see Marks & Spencer's in the exact same category that they'd see, you know, John Lewis and other big classic legacy brands in the UK. And why wouldn't people be flocking to them online and in a digital environment now more than ever, in the same way that they do John Lewis? And what I mean by that is, you know, you want some garden furniture. There might be half a dozen furniture sites that you might go to and DTC startup brands, but you'll also go to John Lewis and check out prices and check out stuff. You would do exactly the same thing with Marks & Spencer. I just feel like they're missing an opportunity here.
I think they've lost their identity somewhat. They don't really know what they are, because on the one hand, I think their food demographic, their grocery demographic is very different from their clothing and homeware demographic. And they've struggled for years in trying to work out who their audience is. And they've accepted the fact that they do attract an older demographic when it comes to their clothing, and they've tried launching younger brands within the Marks & Spencer brand, and that has worked to a certain degree, but they've still always struggled with that. I think that, Rachel, you're talking about, do they understand what the digital customer looks like? No, I don't think they do, which is why they've kind of gone, we'll just shut down for now, because all our customers are in their 80s at least and probably can't use the internet. So we'll just wait until the stores reopen and just forget that, and then just put all the focus onto social. But social is not where their demographic is. So I think they don't actually know who their customer is. It's all very confusing. And I don't know when this article was released on the 20th of May. I'm assuming it was recently, the interview recently happened as well, because they're referring to, they're probably going to start bringing out the loungewear that everyone is searching for at the moment. It's like, I mean, that's
that everybody's living in, basically, the clothes we're wearing all day, every day.
Everyone's got their jogging bottoms now. They don't, you don't need to bring out a range of loungewear because it's being done. And it's this, they're always going to struggle on the fashion front versus the fast fashion brands like ASOS, for example, and all the younger brands like Boohoo and whatever. They're not going to be able to compete with those if they're only now thinking about bringing out their loungewear range. And everyone else did it from literally the day that everyone was told to go home. Everyone was able to go and buy copious amounts of loungewear, which is what they did.
I mean, I don't want to get political about this, but it sounds like they're being run by the Conservative government at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, now, Rachel.
Just a little joke, just a little lighthearted joke.
Just putting it out there.
I think they are very in line with the Conservative government. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, and probably enough said, and in the interest of speeding us through an otherwise hot and stuffy rooms we're sitting in, I'm actually going to move us on to the next story, and I'm going to try not to ask a compounded question. So, great piece from Lara O'Reilly at DigiDay. I'm always saying that when I'm introducing Lara's pieces. I've got to stop saying that. I'm just sounding like such a fangirl. It's getting embarrassing. Sorry, Lara, I'm not obsessed with you, I promise. Anyway...
All good of those piece. Pictures of Lara in your background.
We will be taking a post-podcast photo, Maria, just to prove that is not true. So a piece on what's happening in the TV upfront space, speaking of traditional versus new channels and the digitization of those channels. Obviously, clearly experiencing a lot of disruption, as is everybody else in a pandemic environment. They haven't been able to go ahead as they normally would. There's been some ways of sort of delivering those upfront presentations in more of a digital environment. The article talks about what that is doing to the advertising transaction for TV buyers. It's also talking about the value that brands are getting from signing TV upfront deals where those big tentpole events are not confirmed. So it's typically things around sporting events and, say, awards season, the Grammys, the Emmys, those sorts of things. In the absence of that value that can be offered to advertisers in an upfront pre-agreed way, then where does that leave the sort of upfronts environment, and where does that leave the marketer and the advertiser in terms of their TV buying? Again, questions around whether this could be a permanent change or whether it's just something that's happening for now. And I guess the big question is this is an opportunity for connected TV and for digital TV buying environments? Maria, I've got to go to you first on this.
Sure. Yeah, great article. I agree. I think the upfronts have been disrupted forever with this situation. Obviously, most of the TV stations have just cancelled their presentations or are doing kind of like one-on-ones with agencies. We have a big business in the US, so we're talking a lot with agencies over there because the article was quite US-focused, but, you know, the same has translated over here with, you know, Channel 4 and ITV cancelling late booking fees and all of those things. So I think the key word that we keep hearing from agencies is flexibility. You know, flexibility is something that we're going to need moving forward with regards to TV. The upfronts were created a few decades ago, so it was already a slightly outdated model, and it was created for the automotive industry to be able to plan ahead for the launch of the new cars in the autumn. So I think there was already a sense that model needed disruption, and this has just massively accelerated it. What we're seeing media owners to do is, beyond offering flexibility, also reducing a little bit some of the premiums that they had on addressable TV and matching that a little bit more with their traditional linear TV offerings. And I think that that's interesting because that is going to force a lot more convergence in terms of how buyers see TV as a whole. So you ask about CTV in particular. I think this is about TV as a whole, right? You know, there's a lot of focus, I think, perhaps a bit too much focus on our linear budgets coming to CTV. And again, it's not about kind of like us and them type of thing or digital and linear. It's about TV. And whether that impression is delivered through a smart TV or through a set of box or a tablet, or is linear, kind of like free-to-air TV, it shouldn't matter that much. And I think this is really fueling a lot of conversations, at least, you know, the ones that we are related to, which is more about cross-screen planning and so on, from advertisers to really understand where they should put their money. And they're definitely keeping their budgets close to their chest now and buying a lot more last minute across a much larger number of media and trying to really leverage the data that already exists in places like the US. Europe is a bit trickier. We'll discuss that later. To create plans that are as efficient as possible. So this is going to trigger a business model disruption, because I think there will be a new balance between upfronts are not going to disappear, but it will not be such a significant part of someone's budget. So there will be a new balance in business model. There will be also a new balance in terms of, a new model of pricing, you know, of, you know, addressable versus not addressable and so on. And I think technology is also going to be adopted much more quickly by both media owners and advertisers to be able to buy TV in a more efficient way across any demographic and across any screen. That was a long answer.
But that was really interesting though, because you paint a really interesting picture. I think that's a very important point that you've made, that actually, you know, perhaps much like we did in the print media world many years ago, we need to stop talking about digital and non-digital. And the same can be said for the TV environment, right? That actually this needs to be about the value of TV for advertisers and what that looks like and where that ad impression is delivered. And maybe we're going to start to see more of a holistic conversation happening around that, not least of all because there's just been so much consumer behaviour change, right? We're just consuming everything so much more digitally. In a very short period of time, people have made all sorts of adjustments and changes, and perhaps that's just going to really inspire us to be able to actually start speaking about this in more of a holistic fashion. But the other thing is interesting, as you rightly point out, the article is quite US focused. But are you and you know, agencies are pushing for flexibility, and it makes sense that that's what they want everywhere. But is the picture looking particularly different in Europe? I mean, you've said it's sort of similar, and we're now encroaching on territory for the second part of the podcast, where you're going to tell us a bit more about Life and Amobee and what you're working on. But I'm just interested to know if you feel that we'll see the same acceleration of change across European markets as well, or will that be a bit more fragmented?
I think there will be, you know, there's three things that I pointed out from a business model perspective and giving more flexibility that will happen. I think, look, outside of this lockdown situation, we are heading towards a very steep recession. So advertisers will try to de-risk their commitments and try to invest wisely and in a selective fashion as possible. So that, you know, some of the changes that the broadcasters in Europe have put in place to incentivize spend on TV may actually stay a lot longer than they would desire. From a technology perspective, some of the things that are already possible today in the US, like planned TV across traditional linear and all of the digital spectrum, including CTV or other types of device, that's a bit more difficult over here. Simply because of data fragmentation and data ownership and regulation and so on. And we'll discuss that later. However, what I can say, at least from our perspective, is that there's two things, right? We have seen a lot more spend on CTV and online video, right, than ever before as a weight. But two, and most importantly, because we're speaking to broadcasters quite regularly, many, many broadcasters are definitely looking into launching solutions into market that allow advertisers to have a more holistic view of their linear and digital inventory, to be able to have a little bit more control, so give flexibility but not completely lose all of the control. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Lindsay?
Yeah, I think, I mean, my viewpoints are very, come from a different place from Maria's, and Maria, you can correct me when I kind of don't know what I'm talking about, basically. But it feels like if you the the article being US focused, the US is so much further ahead than the rest of the world when it comes to the connected TV anyway, because it's needed to be because of the strange legacies like that the US market has. And they're the ones that obviously have championed the terms like cord cutters and cord nevers and cord shavers and whatever else the other one is, cordies, I'm assuming. And so there's already this evolution going on there. So it's quite miraculous that through all this evolution, the upfronts have remained quite so steadfast in the US. But as the article points out, they have evolved. So there's been a lot more talks around addressability and measurement when it comes to the upfronts, not just, I want to buy this sports game, and then alongside that, give me some other crappy little TV shows that nobody watches just as a bundle. As you know, that's the broadcaster's way of getting rid of the small TV show that people will not want to buy up front or will not buy in the scatter approach, which obviously is more like RTB versus an IO. And so there is obviously, and I think in the last year's upfront, I think even Hulu were involved in it. So there's obviously a lot more going on. It's not just legacy broadcasters that are looking at the upfront model. But I think that, I don't know if you can completely get rid of upfronts, and really it's the same thing, like the upfronts aren't going to go anywhere. But I think that there will be a high, because if you did get rid of it and you moved purely to a scatter approach where you will buy a TV spot as and when you want it or need it, then you're going to just create like a hidden behind the radar upfront going on with people that will still want that buying heft that they're not going to get with a scatter approach. And, you know, the article talks about advertiser buying heft, but there's also the agency buying heft. You know, to a certain extent, gone are the days where one agency could buy an entire ad slot between like the likes of X Factor, so that every single ad that showed in that ad break was that agency's clients. You know, that there's still kind of that going on, but I think this would eliminate those kind of things as well. And a lot of the kind of the old school trading methodologies when it comes to TV are being replaced by the new connected TV digital methodologies. And the article points out kind of a comment from Jeff Green of the Trade Desk is that it's actually kind of taking the pressure off those buyers a bit, because they want to look into digital transformation. But as long as there's an upfront going on where they have to go, oh, I've got to plan ahead to October so I can make sure I go and buy the Super Bowl and put and spunk God knows how many millions on that one ad slot, I can't then focus on actually what I need to do here and now, and the money that I need to put aside for something that's more interesting, that actually arguably is probably better for my target audience. So I think it will give them the ability to plan better for all TV. We're not looking at linear versus digital, but they'll plan better and be able to probably merge the two together. As Maria, you were talking about the fact that we shouldn't be looking at them in silos. We absolutely shouldn't be, and they shouldn't be lines on media plans. One shouldn't be linear bought out of this team, and one shouldn't be connected TV bought out of this team. Getting rid of the upfronts or making the upfronts more of an inclusive approach to TV buying will probably help to merge those together as well.
Yeah, but that's a really interesting point though, Lindsay, because what's happening in an agency environment? Are we seeing that those buyers will come together? Like you say, some of it's bought in one team, some of it's bought in another team. Are we starting to see that coming together in any way?
Some places though they've realized that the way they buy has to change. And some, and actually even the article mentions it, but the same has happened in the UK as well. Some agencies have lost the people that created all their legacy trading deals. So there were some big people in the UK as well that left their agencies they worked at for 20, 30 years. They were the ones that created these massive legacy trading deals that meant that, you know, they had these deals at ITV and Channel 4 already that you couldn't really break, couldn't really get out of. And if they did, they had their old school media way of dealing with them. They've now gone. So those traditional TV teams are becoming more digital naturally because they're not having to kind of operate in the same way they used to. And I guess that in itself is creating this convergence already. And this will just go to propel it, I would say.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Maria, have you got another perspective on that?
No, I think it's similar. But I think it will evolve. I still think that the organizational factor is an issue. If you speak to, you know, to C-level at any agency, really, and you talk to them about, hey, how would you like to be able to inform all of your decisions, right, across the funnel, and be able to plan across linear TV and digital media in a way that is not going to conduce to waste. They love the idea. But then, you know, when they look down and they realize all of the different departments, sometimes agencies and so on that they have underneath, it's easier said than done. You know, there's a lot of personal capital at stake with regards to some of these decisions, and it's not easy. I would actually venture to say that broadcasters are being a little bit more proactive in being able to get there before agencies are. But again, does it make sense? It makes sense. You know, no one will tell you, I want to waste money. Like that's a reality. But how am I going to transform my organization to get to a place where I can actually leverage the technology that already exists to not waste money is a completely different challenge. And it's one that takes longer, right? You know, technology usually happens first and then organizations follow. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess that would be quite interesting to wonder what it's like perhaps within some of these agencies at the moment where they might have brands coming to them saying, we want to buy differently, we want to buy TV differently. You know, it'll be interesting to see if there's some people within those agencies that are thinking, yes, finally, we actually have, you know, some technology tools that can definitely enable us to do that, but we just haven't ever had the impetus to get on with it in the way that we do now. I don't know.
Yeah, I think brands and agencies would be okay with that because that's how they buy everything else, right? They're used to buying everything else in the short term or the short to medium term, not in the long or long term.
Yeah.
But they've had to think that way for TV, and that's just helped keep TV in its silo. And actually, if they're used to that and they want to be able to do that for everything else, they're going to want the same for TV as well. So it stands to reason that Maria, when you're going and selling them the dream, they're going, yes, that's exactly what I want. Yes, please. Give it to me now. Oh, no, wait. No, there's upfronts coming up. Can't do it. Sorry.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Inertia gets in the way, but we'll get there.
Okay. Moving on to the second part of the podcast, Maria, tell us what you're up to at Amobi, and what you've been focusing on, and maybe a little bit about, you know, whether that focus is shifted during strange times or whether it's practically business as usual.
No, absolutely. Yes, I actually wanted to continue with the topic of TV because I find it fascinating, and it's probably the next, with identity probably related to that too, the next big wave of disruption for the industry. As I said, the US is a lot more advanced. The likes of Forrester have actually already created a new category of platforms that can plan and optimize and activate media across screens. And when I say across screens, that includes linear, obviously, linear TV. So that's all good. And unfortunately, I run the European business. So, yes.
It's a different picture
exactly,
for you.
Yeah. Exactly. But however, the reason I wanted to, I have selected this topic to discuss over here is because we are seeing some early stages of real disruption. And believe me, I've been following this dream for a long time because my background is in video and in broadcasting. And it finally seems that all parties are starting to come together and propelled, I would say, mostly by broadcasters. I'll give a little bit of context about us because, you know, people know Amobi mostly as a DSP in market, as an omnichannel DSP. But Amobi did take a decision a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, to invest quite heavily in the world of TV and in trying to understand TV, not just coming at it from a digital way and trying to, capitalize on the connected TV inventory. I think we see TV more as a whole, as something that we want to crack, period. And obviously it's a very, very large industry. So in part of that strategy, we acquired a company called Videology. They were quite large over here, so I'm sure it's a familiar name to everyone. In Videology, we're pioneers, I would say, in the sense that they had built the technology with TV in mind. So from the way they optimized to the way that the business models work and all of the partnerships that they had with linear TV panels, you know, both in the US and over here in Europe. So integrating that with our DSP, our omnichannel DSP, has kept us busy for a while, and has also helped us do some pretty cool things, right? You know, as I said, this, you know, cross-screen planning, being able to have an advertiser say, well, okay, this is the audience that I want to reach. Let me see. And then, you know, they can understand the different TV networks that they need to purchase in the US and how to complement that with digital media, whether that's CTV or online video or even, you know, other types of digital media. It doesn't really matter because you're able to identify in the US again through a common identity layer when a particular demographic has been underexposed on TV, and then you can find them in other places. So that's great. And again, that has been kind of like a dream I've been following for a while. And having that infrastructure to be able to light it up in Europe once we have the data, the right data partnerships, is a big part of the reason why I joined Upmovie personally. So the reasons I'm excited about Europe are, it's a much more fragmented market. Global players like Nielsen or Comscore or others usually struggle to invest as heavily here simply because of fragmentation and data ownership, the fact that broadcasters own those TV panels and have been not greatly incentivized to break from that. But broadcasters themselves are starting to innovate quite significantly. We are seeing quite a few broadcasters taking steps to create an identity layer that merges their linear panels with a digital identity. And each broadcaster is finding completely, you know, wildly different solutions, you know, whether it's a partnership with Set of Boxes or they have put a sensor in their own player or whatnot, or they're leveraging kind of like one of the common vendors. It doesn't really matter. But that is the first step in being able to offer a converged ecosystem to buyers. And that's very important because that is the one thing that can help them have the right level of scale and the right level of differentiation against the threat that they're seeing from digital ecosystems, right? Mm-hmm. The first step from broadcasters with this threat and digital ecosystems, I'm obviously meaning, you know, Google and Facebook and so on. The first step, when I saw this, at least, you know, from a European basis, was we're just going to hold tight. We're not doing anything. And then suddenly a lot of the money that we're seeing is starting to move away. Their second step was, okay, you know, if advertisers want to trade in this data-driven fashion, let's connect to an SSP and to a DSP, and we do that. And that, you know, in my honest opinion, is a strategic suicide for broadcasters because you lose a lot of control. You're suddenly subject to completely different business models, non-guaranteed. You cannot leverage your assets mostly, which is your data becoming increasingly valuable with a cookieless future, you know, upon us, and your inventor. So being able to actually offer buyers the ability to buy across all of your media in a data-driven fashion is the one thing that they have to do. There's technology to do it now, and we're having a ton of conversations with broadcasters about linear plus digital planning to at the very least understand what it is that they have, and then be able to put that in front of buyers through a fairly TV-based but sophisticated portal of targeting. We have, you know, as you know, a partnership over here with ITV. Their approach was mostly focused on the ITV hub, but the sentiment was the exact same one, right? Let's create an ecosystem that allows advertisers to buy in this data-driven fashion, but in a way that doesn't undermine my assets and that allows me to compete in a fair fashion that just connecting to a third-party DSP. So they're well on the way in that strategy, and they've been very public about their ambition to create a marketplace that would not only include ITV and could be a lot more competitive in market. The second phase of that would be to also include linear inventory. So broadcasters in Europe are approaching this in kind of like different phases, but there is really a lot of activity going on in all of those organizations to crack this notion of convergence and this notion of being able to offer critical mass inventory in a data-driven fashion across all of their media to advertisers. So super excited. It's not going to happen overnight, but a lot of the steps that were needed to get there are definitely underway. So that's the main thing that is keeping us busy over here in Europe, whilst, you know, trying to keep the rest of the business going and weathering the storm of COVID. But it's the kind of thing that makes you really want to go to your home office every morning.
Yeah, I mean, that is really interesting, Maria. It's that's an excellent synopsis of the sort of TV, connected TV landscape, I suppose, to some extent, or your perspective on it to some extent from sort of Amobi's point of view. Because I think, as I said, you know, when we were just sort of having a pre-chat for the podcast, we've talked in the industry a lot about the opportunity for brands and advertisers in connected TV, particularly, you know, beyond, you know, outside of a cookieless, you know, display environment. And then there's been a lot of commentary about the connected TV marketplace over in the US. You know, it's had the advantage perhaps of being a little bit more technologically advanced for a little while, less fragmentation, single language, those sorts of things. And so now I've found the debate has definitely shifted back to, well, you know, does it actually work properly in Europe, you know, in more fragmented markets? And let's imagine that Europe's perhaps a bit further advanced in terms of connected TV than, say, over in APAC, which is another example of potentially a very fragmented market, or at least parts of the APAC market are. So therefore, you know, if we look to Europe, are we seeing connected TV work there? If it's not working there, does it mean it won't work in Asia? And there's just so many different stories being told at the moment. So I've found that synopsis really helpful and really interesting. In your opinion, therefore, is it that we're at this point where, you know, you accept that there has been fragmentation, or fragmentation is just an inherent part of the marketplace in Europe. It's always going to be there, but the uptake or the interest that you're starting to see perhaps from advertisers and brands in connected TV now is being driven by a set of circumstance and by the points that you made, which is that they are wanting to move budgets away from that heavily commoditized, cookied environment in a different media sort of ecosystem to somewhere else. And finally, they've got the technology tools. So is it the sort of perfect storm of things that need to happen to push people, to drive advertisers to the connected TV environment? Or is it that you've had to work really, really hard actually in Europe to bring some compelling sort of proposition together, clearly basing it on where you think there's need, you know, that actually it makes sense that people will want this kind of converged opportunity to buy? So which has come first, I suppose, is what I want to say. Is it hard yards and hard graft, or are we just at the right point in the evolution of the technology tools and perhaps, you know, the sort of potential in terms of, you know, customer behaviour change to make connected TV work in Europe?
Yeah, let me unpack that a little bit. I think, so first of all, connected TV is growing, right? You know, absolutely. And there's a challenge of scale, there's a challenge of data to a certain extent, and so on. So I don't think the industry is ready for a silent, massive shift towards connected TV. But I think, you know, where I have an issue is almost kind of like this concept of shift. Going back to my previous point, are we trying to get budgets from linear TV into a DSP, right? And probably that's not the lens that I personally look at this problem. For me, it's more around, can we have a more consolidated way of thinking about TV that is relatively data driven, or as much as possible? And that's the one thing that will kind of, like, you know, tip the industry into just, you know, buying at a much larger scale on connected TV in particular. I see connected TV as a device, not as a kind of like, not as the end game, but as you know, as one of the means to the end, which would be a better way to trade TV that is a little bit better informed and that encompasses all platforms, that is not as segregated as, you know, digital, which now includes CTV because it's IP based and linear. So yeah, I know that my point of view is slightly different, but I think that unless we can find a way to make all of that offering more consistent, it's going to be difficult to suddenly see a massive shift of TV budgets to connected TV, or at least we'll only see it as connected TV audiences, you know, keep growing. But something more drastic than that would need technology and the ability to see audiences across everywhere, so you can truly call to those TV budgets as opposed to just digital budgets.
And you were sort of saying before as well that you know, that you've noticed some sort of proactive innovation, or you know, you're witnessing some proactive, I suppose, innovation or ways of working within broadcasters. Do you think that's in part because they understand the importance of being holistic in this approach to digitizing their businesses in a way that perhaps print media didn't understand that, or maybe there were many other challenges in that environment that made it impossible for sort of print media businesses to digitize as quickly.
100%. Look, broadcasters are under a ton of pressure, right? You know, the likes of YouTube have been a massive issue for them. And the fact that, as I said, their first reaction was, let's just hold tight and keep trading in the same way that we've always been trading, has not worked out. Advertisers want a lot more visibility on audiences and are questioning, you know, some of the existing currencies as well. You have some players that are coming in to try to do measurement, like Samba TV, right? You know, they can measure TV through their technology, and that challenges the status quo of Barb. And I'm just giving one example, right? Mm. So they know that this is coming, and the reason they're waking up is, one, they're under pressure, but two, they need to play offense. So they actually need to first understand what's going on with their audiences across connected TV and across online video and across, you know, the more traditional TV that is non-addressable. They need to really understand that. They need to make sense of all of that data and marry that panel data with their digital graph. And only when they do that, they can understand how bad the problem could be if other people come in and try to solve that problem for them. So what I'm seeing in Europe is many broadcasters stepping up and trying to audit their audiences across the board and then being able to make an offering to advertisers for those audiences. Because if they don't do it themselves, someone will do it for them. Mm. Advertisers need data. And again, that's why one of the first reactions was to just put some of the inventory in programmatic platforms. But that's not necessarily either what advertisers necessarily want or what they should do strategically. The notion of doing that in a programmatic fashion is because advertisers want data. Okay, give them data. Give them good data. Give them first-party data, which is much better than some third-party cookie that someone is going to layer on a DSP, right, when buying connected TV. Give them good data. Give them good inventory. Give them visibility. And then you actually have a very, very strong position against any other digital ecosystem. Because you can guarantee quality, you can guarantee a lot of other things that will make advertisers feel more uncomfortable. The other element is, you know, because connected TV keeps coming up, if you trade that through a regular DSP, there's a lot of stuff that is related to TV, things that are quite heavy, like compliance and clash and creative approval and so on. You know, the programmatic platforms were not built for TV. Those things are still super important. I think it's very important to keep protecting consumers. I don't want a terrible ad on my telly. I just don't, you know. Like it's a medium I trust. It's a medium I like. I love the serendipity of advertising in TV as well. So I don't necessarily want to be retargeted, you know, for a dog food ad on my TV. And I think we really need, you know, some level of balance, right? And regulators making sure that consumer experience is protected. Because it's a very important part of family life, right? For many families too. So that needs to stay protected. And broadcasters are still in a relatively strong position, but they need to move fast. And the reason, as I said, I was excited is that I am seeing them moving towards that direction faster than ever before in the last 6 months. And then you have, again, they're approaching that through different angles, perhaps, you know, more towards creating an ecosystem or a consortium, or just creating a linear plus digital offer, depending on how advanced they are with their own data. But everyone in Europe is looking at this very, very seriously, and this can only be extremely good for advertisers.
Yeah, it's going to be so interesting to see how things pan out over the kind of coming 6 to 12 months. We've unfortunately run out of time, because that's a conversation I feel like we could, go off into all sorts of avenues. But anyway, let's save ourselves from the hot, sweaty rooms that we're all in and bring the podcast to a close. So thank you very much, Maria. It was great to have you. Thank you very much, Lindsay. And thank you, everyone, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.